This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
One of the most common questions that I get as people realize that AGI is coming sooner or later, there is still some debate over when, but people kind of generally accept, okay, AGI is coming, now what? So this question is, how fast will it be adopted? And what I mean by that is across various countries, such as developing nations versus developed nations, as well as across small businesses or large businesses, and how can we ensure that the benefits are equally distributed? So let's unpack some of that today in today's videos. So the first thing that you need to know is that, and I will caution that this effect is not universally true across all technologies, but in many cases, small companies and developing nations have an advantage for adopting new technologies because there are fewer barriers to adopting and also more need. In other words, those new technologies will be far more transformative to them. So one of the key examples is the development of solar and internet-based internet, such as Starlink. And so the combination of solar and Starlink, for instance, has allowed many rural places, such as in India and Africa, to just go straight from, you know, pre-modern industrialization into the internet age. It's a very fascinating phenomenon. I watched a documentary a few months ago of a camel-based library where they would go from village to village with a bunch of library books on the backs of camels. And then because of these new technologies, they were able to update to just Kindles, which is just a fascinating turn of events. And so this leapfrog effect actually allows for many places to just immediately leapfrog into the future and become modern very quickly. Now, this is obviously not going to account for all of the infrastructure that is required, such as industrialized agriculture, modern schools, but this effect is very pronounced in some fields, such as in health and medicine. So for instance, AI is being adopted much more rapidly, for instance, in rural India, just because it's like, hey, if you have a thing that can help diagnose diseases or, you know, read radiography images better than the people we have, we will use it. Whereas in developed nations, it's like, well, the doctors are all like, you know, I'm better than any machine. And then they'll throw up regulatory barriers and red tape and that sort of stuff. And so you have a very different incentive structure between the developed nations and the developing nations. And so because of that inertia that we have, the economic and social and cultural inertia, along with a massive sense of paralysis, you often will see small companies can adopt AI much faster than bigger companies. Likewise, you can often see developing nations adopting AI much faster than developed nations. So to delve a little bit deeper into that, there are regulatory hurdles. So whether it is approval processes, you know, like in America, we have the FDA. So pretty much any medical device or, you know, drug or whatever needs to go through a very long, expensive, rigorous process. Likewise, there are going to be variances across sectors. So for instance, in some sectors, it's like, whatever, we'll use it if it works. Marketing is an example, you know, video editing. this video is actually edited by AI. So just as an example, but you wouldn't see that in medicine, law, a few other places, because again, some of the structures in place, one, they're many, many decades old. So this is kind of the crux of it. Many, many regulations are decades old, and they were created at a time even before modern automation, let alone the idea of AI level automation. And so you end up with these policies that are built around the assumption, the core assumption, that humans and only humans can do the entire process. But again, when you take a first principles look, what is actually required to do a thing, whether it's to cultivate a field and grow crops, or what is actually required to look at a contract and negotiate it, what is actually required to do test results and diagnose a disease accurately. Even when AI and machines are able to do these things, you have to overcome a lot of assumptions. And again, the key thing to look at is the incentives. Doctors in America want to keep making their big salaries. Lawyers want to keep making their big salaries. The institutions, the laws, the regulations have all been built over many decades with a bunch of assumptions. When you go to a developing nation, you often have none of those assumptions, but you also have very urgent unmet needs. And so it's the first thing that is cheapest that is able to do it. And so we should expect to see very fast adoption of AI in healthcare and education, for instance, in the developing world. And that's without doing anything special or, other than the fact that it is better, faster, cheaper, and safer than humans, you will get almost immediate adoption in the developing world. Whereas more and more often, so here's an example. The American power grid is very antiquated. We were first out of the gate in terms of building a power grid as big and sophisticated as ours, but we haven't renovated it in decades. So modern power grids that are being built for the first time in developing nations are often far more sophisticated than the power grid here in America. So this is kind of that fossilization, that ossification that happens when you have first mover advantage, is you kind of get paralyzed. Now, as a student of history, what I will say is that there is a lot of historical precedent for this. So the Dutch East India Company was the first kind of global, what you might think of as a global corporation. And the Dutch were very much ahead of their time in the construction of seagoing trading vessels. So they had first mover advantage, right? Silicon Valley is not the inventor of first mover advantage. The Dutch had first mover advantage with their new sailing ships. But then England, which at the time was basically a backwater, said, hey, what are the Dutch doing? And so they studied the Dutch building process, they studied their banking, they studied their trade routes, and then they copied it and did better. And so this actually helped England eventually become the first truly global empire. And so this is something that a lot of people are afraid of, because right now America is still kind of the de facto leader in a lot of technologies, but China is very, very deliberately studying and copying us. It's kind of a joke. You've probably seen the SpongeBob SquarePants meme. Like it's a little video clip of U.S. is SpongeBob, making a Krabby Patty, and then China is Patrick, who's copying SpongeBob, and then SpongeBob puts his hand on the burner, but it's a fake hand. Anyways, down a rabbit hole. Point being is that we make fun of China for copying everything that the U.S. is doing, but there is historical precedent for that. They are literally following England's playbook, which is copy success. Even if you don't understand it, just keep copying it. And over the course of literally centuries, because this is the time scale that Chinese think in, because they're not empire, but their nation has been around for many, many centuries. They say, okay, it might take us 100 years, but we will figure out everything that the Americans are doing and we will overtake them. And so that very deliberate effort of saying, hey, we're not the world leaders, but we're going to copy success. This comes directly from Sun Tzu's Art of War. It is right to learn even from your enemies, especially from your enemies. And I'm not saying that America and China are blood feud, enemies to the death, at least not right now. Hopefully that never happens, but we'll see. Now, another thing that I want to point out is that there are often technological catalysts. So basically, especially over the last 400 or 500 years, starting with the sailing ships of the Dutch and the English, moving forward, or around the same time was the printing press, and then moving forward to steam power, rail, electricity, you know, electrification that was really kind of ramping up about 100 years ago, a little bit more, then the internet age. Technology is always a catalyst for some of these changes and these transformations. And so today we have artificial intelligence is here and it's ramping up. We have fusion on the horizon. We have quantum computing on the horizon. So we have a whole bunch of technologies which are going to, in all likelihood, create a positive cycle or a positive feedback loop or a virtuous cycle, sorry. And this virtuous cycle is going to create compounding returns. And so we are going through another major catalyst, which could reshape the balance of power, you know, geopolitically, but it could also, at the very least, spurn a lot of new innovation. And so one of the examples that I like to think of is all of the technological innovations and economic innovations that happened because of World War II. That's basically what we're doing again, hopefully without the war. So this is kind of the primary, one of the primary things that I hope for, which is one of the reasons that I'm very optimistic about the future, is because, yes, America and China are locked in kind of a new technological arms race. Hopefully, we can both benefit from the technological advancements without actually going to war or even fighting proxy wars. I think the world is tired of great power proxy wars, so time will tell on that front. But either way, we all stand to benefit if we use this catalyst, this moment of this fourth industrial revolution as a technological catalyst to really restructure society and the economy and geopolitics. But if we do it in a peaceful, friendly manner, you can wish in one hand, right? So speaking of the shifting world order, there are a few things that make me wonder like how this is going to play out. So right now, China is the number two world economy, only behind the United States. But this is not the first time that this has happened in the last 50 years. We had the Soviet Union was the number two, you know, global power, but now that's no longer true. Likewise, you know, we had Japan was the number two world economy. That is no longer true. So really kind of what it looks like to me is we're playing a game of economic chicken. You know, China is trying to catch up, whether or not they will be able to. And one thing that I like to think of is that Russia or Soviet Union at the time, there was no physical reason that it couldn't overtake the United States. It was physically larger. It had an hyperabundance of fossil fuels in the form of gas and oil. It had all the energy it needed. It had all the land that it needed. It could have economically overtaken America, except for the social, cultural, economic, and intellectual limitations. And I'm not saying that like Russians are dumb. What I mean is the beliefs that they had cultivated around economics, the beliefs that they had cultivated around politics and the way that society should be run and structured, that's where the Soviet Union primarily failed. If you take a first principles look at the economic potential that the Soviet Union had, there was no reason that it should have failed the way that it did. But that goes to show that if you have the wrong theory, if you have the wrong system, the wrong set of beliefs, you will not manage to stick the landing of development. Likewise, when you look at China, China is actually more resource poor than Russia. And so that is actually a limiting factor that China has. Likewise, their beliefs around economics and politics and society might be the primary limiting factor. However, I've been learning more about history and kind of the theory of where China is going. And they really are thinking in the timeline of 200 to 300 years. So if China doesn't overtake America by 2050, that doesn't mean that it's never going to happen. Because again, they're constantly studying the theory of what other people are doing. Now, I don't necessarily agree with their approach, and I don't necessarily agree with their conclusions, because like I just learned that Mao Zedong was an incredibly well-read person, very philosophical, very deep thinking, but he still took it in the wrong direction. So we will see if the world order shifts in the way that it does, but put it another way, this isn't our first rodeo. So we'll see what happens in terms of global adoption of AI and the impact that it'll have, because, you know, AI on its own, AI doesn't exist in a vacuum. That's kind of the implication here. So how do we navigate this transition? How do we go from here to a better future? How do we chart that course? So first, using that leapfrog logic, I've talked to consultants. Small businesses absolutely have an advantage, whether it's an existing small business or a startup that is built around an AI-first model. We're starting to see those. So I actually have an upcoming interview with the founder of Ask Sage. So you look for that, because that was a company that was built around AI to serve a particular purpose. Likewise, developing nations have usually a lot more impetus and a lot less friction for adopting AI. So small businesses, developing nations, they're actually going to benefit more and faster from these technological advancements. However, developed nations have to look at internal risk assessments in terms of their geopolitical orientation and using regulation correctly, because you can actually use regulation to accelerate things. The primary example is standards. So interoperability, using regulation for interoperability, is probably one of the best ways that you can use regulation in order to accelerate things. IEEE standards, IPv6, as an example, these are ways where standardization can allow everyone to collaborate and move much faster. Now, that's not the only way that you can use regulation to accelerate innovation. And certainly you can do it wrong, because if you choose the wrong standard, which has been done plenty of times in the past as well, that can actually hamper innovation. Likewise, you can also regulate industries out of existence, or you can use regulations to really slam on the brakes and go against innovation. And so this is going to be one of the key things where nations, developed nations, have to make a decision and be very careful about saying, hey, we want to make sure that we incentivize rapid deployment. We also want to make sure that we incentivize accountability, because AI can be used to do a lot of harm. One of the key things that I'm worried about is if we don't manage to reallocate resources, then we could be heading for civil war. And the reason that I believe that is, and that's the worst case scenario. We've had peaceful restructurings in the past without civil war, namely the Square Deal by Teddy Roosevelt, and then the New Deal by his cousin Franklin Roosevelt. So those are two examples of America within the last century or so going through peaceful economic restructurings that were facilitated in part by new technologies and new economic paradigms. We've done it before. We can probably do it again. But if the existing institutions are too rigid and not flexible enough, and we're not allowed to reconcile new technologies and new values, then, violent uprising might be in our future. Now, I'm not calling for it by no means. Actually, that's one of the key things that I'm trying to do, is trying to avoid that. But I want to point out this could lead to that if we don't do it right. But it does come down to new paradigms that are afforded to us by these new technological trends. Just as every industrial revolution and every other intellectual revolution from, the printing press and global trade from the East India Company onward, these have all created paradigm shifts, both political and economic. So we just need to be aware of the fact that these paradigm shifts are coming, and it's a forcing function being driven by technology. No amount of political willpower will prevent this tidal wave from coming. Now, there's also some cultural paradigms that happen. So one thing that people often talk about is like, Dave, you're talking about the fourth turning. And I looked into the fourth turning. I think Joe Scott just recently did a video about it, and it's really, really interesting. So go watch his video. I don't really believe in the fourth turning, but having listened to Ray Dalio, who talks about the rise and fall of nations and debt cycles, I think the fourth turning actually is a misinterpretation of those debt cycles. And so what happens is you will have global cycles of the rise and fall of nations, which usually takes about 300 years. Give or take, a few centuries. And so then you'll have this reshuffling of the world order. So you had the Spanish main and the French Empire, and then you had the English Empire, and now you have the American Empire. And so it just keeps cycling. Likewise, within those nations, you have cycles of innovation and stagnation. You have cycles of left politics versus right politics. And so all of these cycles kind of add up to create what looks like a sound wave, honestly. And so then over time, you have these rotating cultural values. And so if you believe in these theories, we are past the peak right now. And so we're heading towards things getting more and more painful until things are painful enough. And what I mean is specifically in America and probably also Europe. I think Europe is probably further ahead, looking at kind of the economic pain that particularly France and Italy are feeling. I think Germany is okay right now. But England, France, and Italy are in pretty economic dire straits. So they're a little bit further ahead in this curve. And things are going to get more and more painful until something breaks. And everything shakes loose, and then things are restructured. Now, like I said, that does not guarantee violent revolution, but you will get a paradigm shift. And so what you end up with is this rising sense of despair that particularly young people have. That is a sign that we're less hopeful about the future. And so it's like things are going in the wrong direction, and they're continuing to get worse, and they will continue to get worse until there's a forcing function, and people say, you know what? Let's throw things out and start over. Now, in some cases, that basically results in, you know, civil war, some kind of uprising, rebellion, but it doesn't have to. Like I said, here in America, we have had two economic paradigm shifts that were nonviolent, and so we can do it again. France, Italy, we have proven that we are capable of peaceful revolution here in the Western world. Now, that's no guarantee of past performance is no guarantee of future performance. However, these cycles do happen. And so if you read the writing on the wall, we are heading for a paradigm shift and AI is going to be the catalyst. That's the key takeaway. So I've talked about this quite a lot, is economic agency is kind of the key thing to pay attention to. When people accept that AI is going to destroy jobs and that AI could allow for an incredible concentration of wealth among the elite and the powerful, they say, okay, well, so now what? You know, if you lose your job, if there's no jobs to go around anymore, how do you, you know, have any kind of authority over your own economic fate? And people are very rapid to point out, you don't want to rely only on the government. Even if UBI does work and it can provide a comfortable level of living, you don't necessarily want to put all your eggs in one basket. So this is why I also talk about structural incentives. Right now, we have enough economic agency. You can choose to work for an employer. You can choose to start a business. You can choose to get on YouTube like I did. There's a lot of things that you can choose to do. You can buy and sell property. But if all jobs go away, and like even my job might go away, like there are AI-only YouTube channels out there now, those might replace all of us. We don't know. And so if you lose economic agency, this is one of the surest things that has caused civil wars in the past, which is why I'm not pulling my punches anymore. Like, we do stand a risk for civil unrest, because even if the economy itself is going really well, you can still have people with no economic agency. And the way that that works is because the economy is based on the production of goods and services. If AI can produce goods and services, the economy is technically doing fine. But if people don't have economic agency, they're not going to be happy about it. And so this is one of the primary things that I've been studying and talking to people about, is how do we pivot to a post-labor economy, a hyper-capital economy, and ensure that people have economic agency? Now, a lot of people have talked about communism and socialism and blockchain and, you know, DAOs and that sort of stuff. And I think that it's going to be a little bit of everything. I don't think we can abide a one-size-fits-all solution. It's going to have to be hundreds and hundreds of little changes and some bigger changes here and there in order to make this transition. And so the correct time to start doing these experiments is now. Well, actually, the best time to start doing these experiments around new economic paradigms is like a year ago. The second best time is now. As things get worse and as the technology ramps up, so you're going to have like, we've already been on kind of this downward trend for a while, and now technology is ramping up. And so you're going to end up with this inflection point. And that's when the cycle is going to restart. And so this is one of the things that accelerationists talk about, is let's just go ahead and get to that cycle restarting as fast as possible. I disagree, because when you have these accelerationist mentalities, if things get too painful too fast, that's when you end up with war. Now, that being said, this cycle restarting is inevitable. It's like Thanos and the snap. It is inevitable. You can't get off the roller coaster, But what you can do is you can tap the brakes and you can brace for impact, which is, that's literally the primary point of this channel, is to communicate this message and get people thinking in the right direction so that we can make that transition as smoothly as possible. Now, one thing that's going to happen is that as particularly as younger people, because like I'm economically doing okay. So I'm not one of the people that's going to be pushing super hard to, you know, burn it all down and start over. But younger people who are not doing as well, or people my age who are not doing as well, they're going to have a lot more energy for change. They're going to have a lot more hunger to say, you know what, this isn't working for me. And honestly, this is actually why I think, what is it, like 53% of millennials, people my age, don't believe in capitalism anymore. That number is just like, that's strange. This is a sign of what's happening. And really what that is, one way to interpret that is saying, we know that this isn't working for us, and we don't see hope in this future. We don't see hope in this paradigm. We want something new. And so that's part of what I'm here to help create, is what is that new thing that we need? What is that new paradigm that we need? Whether it's a social paradigm, a cultural paradigm, economic, political paradigms, this is all part of what I'm exploring with this channel. So a key thing that happens when the cycle restarts is power redistribution. Whether it was the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the American Civil War, the Arab Spring, the Russian Revolution, the Great Leap Forward, all of these were about restructuring the power of a nation. And sometimes you rebalance the power between nations, but right now I'm really focusing on internal affairs of nations. And so what you do is, because of these new economic paradigms, because of the economic pain that people are in, you end up with a lot of political willpower to say, you know what, let's tear down this institution and rebuild it. Let's change something. And so kind of like what you'd expect is you would want to see a very, what typically happens, I'll say this, is you end up with a populist demagogue like we had with Trump. The thing is, though, is I don't know that Trump was equipped to navigate this change. And it also might have been a little bit early. But the election of someone like Trump is a sign of things to come, where you have someone who is just very energetic, willing to break things, willing to challenge the norms, who is an outsider and an activist. So we should expect, you know, I think Joe Biden getting elected was, people were like, okay, that was a little too much. Let's go back to like white bread, plain vanilla, you know, politics for a little bit. But we should expect to see another activist politician coming in America before too long. And so the two things that this activist is going to need to challenge, as far as I can tell, is one, the military-industrial complex. So when you look at how slow and ineffective like the SLS is at NASA, when you look at how incredibly expensive and entitled and privileged the defense industry is, and the fact that it's just above scrutiny, that's a problem. That is a rigid, paralyzed economic institution that is inefficient, it's wasteful, it's backwards, and it's also emblematic of a previous paradigm. The second thing is the revolving door of politics and lobbyists. And so these are some of the democratic reforms that are going to need to be implemented as part of this transition. Again, I don't have the full picture. Like I said, it's going to be literally hundreds, if not thousands, of little changes and dozens of bigger changes to create this new economic and political paradigm. But part of what happens is the redistribution of power. Because right now, power is too concentrated, and it's getting more concentrated. Now, another thing that we need to think about in terms of how do we get equitable distribution of economic agency and power in the future is we need to come to terms with the fact that the economic future is very capital intensive. And so what I mean by that is, if you accept that we're heading for a post-labor economy, meaning that human labor is not economically viable, that by default means that we are heading for a capital intensive future, which means those who own the capital are going to be the ones who have all the economic power, and economic power translates to, guess what, political power. And so as the importance of human labor goes down, you lose economic agency, you also lose political clout. That means part of what we need for the future is we need to have more decentralized, collective, private ownership of the capital, which is why I say that UBI, even if it does work, is not a complete solution because of those power structures. if you are 100% dependent on the government, that creates perverse incentives for the government to just do whatever it wants. So you don't want that future. So this is why I'm a big fan of blockchain technology, decentralized autonomous organizations. You know, I've talked to some people about it. Tokenizing all property so that it can be easily traded. Maybe that's part of the solution. I don't really know. But we do need something new. We need some new legal precedent, economic precedent for better models of ownership. Because again, we are heading, by definition, you know, a post-labor economy is the flip side of that is a hyper-capital economy, where capital is the only thing that matters in the future, or the primary thing that matters. I won't say the only thing, but where if machines are all as smart as Einstein and all as productive as, you know, the most productive human workers, 10 times more so, then whoever owns the machines, they own the economy and therefore they own politics. And that's not, that is how you get the cyberpunk dystopian hell that we want to avoid, or worse. So some of these economic reformations means that we need new metrics. We need to measure new things. We need to optimize for new things. So looking at inequality and having that as a primary benchmark. So like the Gini coefficient, for instance, political power, measuring people's economic agency. That is actually probably a new benchmark that we need. And I don't even know how to measure that yet. I've done some thought experiments with the help of ChatGPT. It's very difficult and not intuitive to measure economic agency because it's not just a matter of how many dollars you have. It's what you're allowed to do with those dollars and how do you get more dollars, right? Because if you get money, what do you then do with it? And then how do you ensure that the money stays in circulation? What are you allowed to do with that money? And ideally, this future that we're building, you actually end up with more options than you have today. And if you want economic agency to go up and to the right, you want more of it. I don't know how to get that right now, but this is going to be a major evolution of all of the assumptions that we make about the economy, because for literally all of human history, the economy was predicated on human labor. And now it's more and more predicated on machine labor, and eventually we'll just end up with no human labor. And so this means that we'll need new economic paradigms around ownership. Again, I don't know how to implement it, but I know what's coming, and I know that this is going to be a big part of it. So thanks for watching. I hope you got a lot out of this. Let me know what you think in the comments. Oh, by the way, I know about a third of you watched till the very end. I do have a new post-labor economics group on LinkedIn. It's a professional network. Link should be in the description. So cheers. Thanks for watching. Yeah, let me know. Cheers. I said that already.